Hey listeners, this is your host, Abir Sichter. On this episode of Local Global Leaders, titled Everybody Has a Voice at the Table, I spoke with Angie Cruz-Tinch, the Chief Executive Officer of Special Olympics Kentucky. Angie talks about her dedication to empowerment for everybody, including supporting people with intellectual disabilities in her current role, and about her past work supporting young women through her role at the Girl Scouts. I really enjoyed her passion and her resilience and her dedication to kindness and her approach around change management and the way she creates pathways for everyone. Hope you enjoy listening. Greetings, listeners. I'm here in the studio today with the CEO of Special Olympics of Kentucky, Angie Cruz-Tinch. Angie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We're really excited to have you and to hear about the great work you're doing here in Kentucky in empowering our community, empowering young people, empowering amazing athletes for the future. So just so honored to have you today, especially as someone I have a background working in disability employment and disability inclusion. So just really, really honored to be speaking with you.
Wow. Well, thank you.
But first, starting out, I want to hear your six-word story. What are six words you'd use to describe yourself and your story?
The six words I would use are authentic, resilient, intentional, strategic, thoughtful, and curious. I had to look to make sure that was six. So, yes, those would be the six that I would use.
Awesome. Those are six awesome words to hear. And going off of that, we want to know more about how you became a leader. So what do you want to tell leaders about yourself off the bat and your and what got you into being a leader in your community?
I think for one thing, my leadership journey, it's not done. It's ongoing, and I anticipate it will be for the rest of my life. I've always been driven, even as when I was younger. I was very driven, and I am a learner. I am very observant of the world around me and how the people around me are impacted by their environment. I was a sociology major, and so I think that a lot of that, I love that. I love observing people. I love observing them in their environments and just how they impact others. And so I learned early on to meet people where they are. And I think that really guides me in the decisions that I make as a leader on a daily basis.
Awesome. Excited to hear you're a sociology major. That was my sociology class. Was one of my favorite classes in school. Shout out to Dr. Mark Austin at U of L. But I'd love to hear more. Like, yeah, how did like studying sociology and that social environmental aspect kind of like influence you early on?
I think that when you grow up in a certain area and you may not be exposed to certain things outside of you, I think that was the thing with sociology, is that it's not the judgment of people, it's the observation. And it's the observation of environment. And I think how we respond to our environment and how our environment responds to us, and then how that in tune, you kind of move that forward and it impacts other people, the way that you are and the way that others are. And I think that for me, sociology was that. It gave me an opportunity to ask the next question and not to take things at face value. And so I know a lot of people get their information from social media, but I've always encouraged people, just what's that next question? If you see a statistic, then ask the next question, and then keep asking until you've run out of questions. And I think that's how we become good just stewards of our environment and of each other, just making sure that we're actually seeing people for who they are and what they are.
I like that theme of like it influencing you to ask the next question and to kind of always be curious, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
That's awesome. And I want to hear more. You know, you talked about that with sociology. What motivates you to be a leader in your community, and what led you to your current role?
The majority of my career has been focused on nonprofit work. And early in my career, I worked for an organization that provided direct care services to individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I really just always felt at home in that space. And fast forward a few years from that, because that was a few decades ago, but my nephew Garner was born, and Garner was born with Down syndrome. And as he got older, he was involved in different activities. One was Special Olympics. And I went to cheer him on at one of his events at Summer Games. And I'm not a squishy, feely person. And I think I made it 20 minutes without feeling just that overwhelm of emotion, just watching that and just being able to see the atmosphere where you've got thousands of people that are cheering on athletes, and athletes are showing what they are what they're made of, and they get to be celebrated for exactly who they are. And for me, it was that moment I was hooked. And the event was fantastic. Just the atmosphere was fantastic. And so that's what led me really to Special Olympics. So when an opportunity came up, the CEO of Special Olympics, for many years, Special Olympics Kentucky, she retired. And I just happened to see the job posting. And it's one of those things that you're in the right time, right place, right place, right time. And I think that has led me, just that first exposure with Special Olympics really led me to want to pursue a career with this organization.
That's amazing. It's so great to hear. I think with sports and athletics, we think so much about like the competitiveness and winning. But like you said, you found more of that celebration, that wonder,
yes,
right, that really inspired you,
yeah,
to do that work.
Yeah. And there's competition, there's smack talk, just like there is anywhere else. And so a lot of athletes, it just depends on what they're showing up for. And so we've got a lot of athletes that are showing up because they want their time to be better. They're showing up for the gold medal. They're showing up because they want to beat you. There are athletes that want to show up because they get to see their friends. They get to hang out with their friends. But I think the one thing that is consistent is they are celebrated for them. And so that has just been incredible for me. Every day, I seriously can't believe this is my job. That every event that I go to, that I get to do this for a living is pretty amazing.
That's so awesome to hear. And in addition to this current role, I know previously you worked for the Girl Scouts of Kentucky's Wilderness Road as Chief Strategy Officer. So can you tell us more about that work and how it influenced you as a leader?
Sure. So my work at Kentucky's Girl Scouts of Kentucky's Wilderness Road, it really gave me the opportunity to work in a nonprofit at every level. I started out entry level. I actually started out as a volunteer, didn't realize that Girl Scouts paid people to work there. And so then I became a staff member. And I worked, I think, literally in every department while I was there. And I started in membership, went to program, and then it really gave me the ability to see the business as a whole and to see the business, the big picture, but also to focus on people and put people first. Because at one point, I think I had five different titles while I was there, but one was chief of staff at one time. And then as the world shifted, things shifted, and the needs of the business shifted. And so we really needed a strategy. And so that's kind of what led me to the strategy piece of it. And I think I became really skilled in seeing what a business needs to operate in good times and in bad times, and also just to see that our people, and I made lots of mistakes. So whenever you don't put the people first, and that's what I think I learned the most at Girl Scouts, is whenever you don't put people first, then the business is going to fail. And so the people strategy, the business strategy is really what led me to the Chief Strategy Officer position.
That's awesome. I'd love to hear more about, you said how you learned about how a business works both in good times and bad times. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that?
In every nonprofit, you're funded in different ways. And Girl Scouts, there's a reliance on cookie program and the fall product program and then just funders and grants. So whenever you have a pandemic, when you can't have that business, that one-on-one business relationships that girls rely on in order to sell cookies, whenever you have funders that they've lost money, so they can't really fund the grants anymore. So that there were times that it was fantastic. The money, you didn't have to worry about money, because camps were thriving. We had people that were staying, retention. The girls, they were doing an incredible job selling cookies and working on their own individual businesses. And then there's times that you may lose, there's delays in product. There are product increases, the price increases. And so everything comes down to, I mean, it's a business at the end of the day. And so what you have to learn to do is pivot, and everybody hates that word, I know, but you have to learn to do that, to see where your people are strong, what programs are strong, what's the ROI on the programs that you're already doing, and do you just focus more on that? Do you have to diversify your funding? And so I think that's what we all really learned, especially 2020. We were no longer, our main audience was in the schools. Schools were shut down. And so we couldn't even recruit girls from schools. So you had to really change the business model. And that's what we did. And I remember, I mean, March 13th, 2020. We can all probably remember exactly where we were then. And I remember sitting with the leadership team and we were making these decisions of not knowing if it was going to be 2 weeks. Is it going to be 6 weeks? Is it going to be, we don't know. And so you have to just stay very resilient, very nimble. And I think that's what I took away most from that, and that our world, it changed. And so we had been a business that your butt is in the seat from 8 to 5 every day. You couldn't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. So we had to become mobile. We had to make sure that everybody had what they needed to be able to still do good work from home, and that our volunteers and that our girls were still served in the way that they deserve to be served. So it was really just the resiliency, I think, that a lot of us gained during that time. You just, in a nonprofit business, in any business, but you have to have that, and you have to understand where everything is coming from, where your funding, where your membership, where everything is coming from.
And it's so great that you said you had that experience of, before becoming like a C-suite executive with the Girl Scouts, you know, worked in so many different departments mm-hmm. all over. What was your favorite role you had before in the Girl Scouts?
I would say probably I loved my program time there, where it was that one-on-one contact with girls and one-on-one contact with volunteers and in the schools, and really seeing what the Girl Scout program did for girls, the leadership value of it. I love that part. The other part that I probably loved the most was just the staff development. It was an incredible group of people that I got to work with every day, and we did a leadership development program so that you fill that pipeline so that I can replace myself, and so that we can all at the C-suite level can eventually replace yourself and work yourself out of a job because you've created all of these other leaders. I loved that project, and it was something that did for years that I've kind of brought with me into my new role. But I think that's one thing that served us the best as far as just an organization and a business as a whole, because it really, we were a leadership development program organization with Girl Scouts, and so our staff needed to have those same skill development, the same qualities that we were expecting our girls to have. So that was really a lot of fun.
It's really amazing to hear that story. My family, and I'll say my culture and I, like, it's very important to us to hear about like that women's empowerment and women's leadership. My family comes from the nation of Bangladesh, where we've had actually 2 female prime ministers. And then my mom is currently serving as the first female president of the Bangladesh Medical Association of North America.
Oh, wow.
So it's just great to hear. Like, I would just love hearing about empowering women. Mm-hmm. Again, for both me personally, something I care about, but also just my community and my culture and my family. Just really, really amazed to hear that.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate, it's always nice to have a gentleman say that because a lot of times I don't know that, and my husband, he has said to me, he's like, I know what it means. I know what it feels like to be a black man. He said, but I have no idea what it feels like to be a woman. He mm-hmm. said, it is a whole other game that you all have to deal with on a daily basis. And I think that is the things that we as women have to think about, just our general safety, our general, just are we as good as the mediocre person next to us, or we have to be so much better. And I think that having girls that start early on, understanding their value, understanding their worth, understanding that they can lead, because there was one campaign that Girl Scouts did at one point, was it's banned the word bossy, that we're not, mm-hmm. it's not bossy, it's just that you're owning your space. And where women and girls are, you know, labeled as bossy, where men are labeled as just successful mm-hmm. or they're just assertive. So I think that's the thing with women's empowerment is, let's just create that opportunity for girls so that they can become strong women that they're meant to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate that reflection and thinking about how we can't, you know, we can, of course, be allies with each other, but it's hard to understand that experience and really thinking about that holistically. I mean, I think about whenever I have some young students, people I mentor, and whenever I give them, advice on applying for a job, for example, if I'm giving advice to a woman, I'll say, hey, here's my advice, but make sure you please ask another woman, because I will give you advice that works well for a man. Yeah. I think some of my advice is universal, but, please ask them, because they may give you very mm-hmm. different advice, and you should just, you know, probably lean toward them or do a combination of what we both say or other people. But yeah, you have to think about those things mm-hmm. of what you know and what people have to struggle with and experience, just different.
Right, right. And I think that's why representation is so important. And I feel like my work with Girl Scouts and with Special Olympics, that's really where my focus is making sure that representation is everywhere. So with Girl Scouts, it was providing female mentors. In Special Olympics, it's making sure that our athletes are seen as athletes in the community and that they get to see other athletes like them and again, celebrated for who they are.
Yeah, that representation is so important.
Yeah.
And it's great to hear about, I mean, you talked about the celebration, the successes, but also some of those challenges. So I think that's a great lead into hearing about what the biggest struggles are that you've encountered in your leadership journey, whether in your current role or in prior roles.
I think this is one, there's always going to be struggles, but I think one of the biggest struggles that I've had is change and change management. So leading through change and then managing what that change looks like. And I think that the reason this is consistently a struggle for everyone, I don't think I'm unique in this, is that people are always involved and with people come feelings. So you can have the best processes ready to go. But and there's tons of change management models that you can use that are great. They're great guides. But at the end of the day, I think that you've got to consider the unique employees that are involved. And I've done this really, really well. And I have done this really, really poorly and failed miserably. And so I think whenever I have failed, that's been my opportunity to change, my opportunity to adjust. And I think one huge failure that I believe I had was during a restructure. And I had my processes. I'm a process person. So I had my processes. I had everything ready to go. And I am always eager to change. I am not one that I guess I don't find it scary. I find it exciting. But not everybody feels that way. And I think that everybody has to go through their own process. For me, it was really, I was wanting people to move at the same speed that I was moving at, and that wasn't fair. And so I didn't put people first during that, and ended up, I mean, half of our staff left because we had to restructure everything, and I think I could have done that much, much better. So that was about 10 years ago. So I learned from that, and what I have learned is that there are people that are going to be ready to change. There are people that are going to be resistant to change, but they don't think they're resistant to change. And then there's going to be people that are just flat out, they don't want to do it, and they're not going to do it. And so you have to make small adjustments, and you have to get to know people, and you have to do the little things for the big returns. And so that I feel like I've done well, because I can see people now for who they are individually and what they're bringing to the table individually. And I try to make sure that they understand where those strengths fit into the change management that we're going through and how it's going to benefit the business in the long run.
Yeah. I like that you emphasize that importance of, like you said, like having, yes, those processes and change management, but also, like you said, being people first. I think that shows that, you know, being an effective leader and managing an organization, it's a balance between like having those objective measures that may not be as objective as we think, but you also have to like be subjective.
Yeah.
Like you have to think about the individuals. And to hear you be so upfront about like making those mistakes and failure, I mean, I think that's a really great lesson for people to hear. It makes me think of a grand Jedi Master Yoda saying failure is the greatest teacher.
Absolutely.
And I think that ties back really well to the lesson of resilience you mentioned earlier. Now you have to be resilient through failure and get through that.
Yes, absolutely.
And with that, in addition to those struggles, do you have experiences or examples of like toxic leadership you've seen and that you've learned from?
I have. And I think probably one, again, that I think we can all relate to is micromanagers. And I think there's a time and place to micromanage and to lead that way. But it is not a sustainable way to lead. And I have worked for micromanagers. I have worked with micromanagers. I have come after micromanagers. And so it's with micromanagement, you leave a trail of a workforce that does not understand what their value is and really how powerful they can be. And so I think that has been the biggest challenge. And it's what I've found with micromanagers is that's a transactional way to lead. It is not a transformational way to lead. Whenever you don't allow people to figure things out for themselves, and this is something that I worry about too with a lot of people, is just lack of critical thinking. So whenever you don't get to make those mistakes, you don't get to have those failures, whenever you're in a culture that is full of shame and that you, if you make a mistake, you either are persecuted for it or you try to hide it, then it's not healthy and it's not sustainable. So I think that's one that most of us can relate to on some level. Yeah. And that's been the most prevailing, I think, throughout my career that I've seen.
Yeah. I mean, I've experienced a lot of that too. And I liked how you put like there kind of is a time and place where you can sort of be a micromanager. Would you say it's maybe like, I think being a micromanager is more of a systemic thing if someone's always doing it. You know, maybe on your first day of work, okay, like I'll take a closer worker the first time you submit something for me to review. Yeah, I'll like review that in depth. But like, were you saying maybe something like that where it's not systematic? Like,
correct.
Yeah, like things like that. Like, yeah.
Yeah. When you've got a brand new staff member, you absolutely need to guide them and micromanage what they're doing for a little bit just to make sure that they understand what the responsibilities are. But I also think that if you get a new position, you're in the same organization, but you're promoted, that's also a time because you're learning. You're back to square one. You're learning your position all over again. And so, but it's can't be a long term. I think that micromanagers don't trust, and they hold people accountable for things that they've put out there, not what shared goals or shared opportunities. So I think that everything has to be built on trust and accountability. And that's just not something that micromanagers have a tendency to have. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I think it is appropriate in certain times and also emergencies. Like if there's an emergency, absolutely. Yeah. You've got to lead by just telling people what the steps are. This is what we have to get through. But then you go back.
Yeah. And I think you touched on this question, mentioning with change management and being people first, too. Mm-hmm. What would you say is your overall leadership style or philosophy?
It's always been create more leaders, not followers. And so if I always feel like it is my job to work myself out of my job, and if I can do that, I've been successful. If some of the greatest highlights of my career have been watching people that I've had an opportunity to mentor, I've had an opportunity to work with, that have gone on to start their own businesses, or they've gone on to take roles that were elevated because of the work that we had done together. So I think that when you are just trying to create followers, then that's a problem, and that's not a leadership style. That's not a sustainable leadership style for me. And I think that we have to let people be empowered by their individual strengths, by their talents. And so we do Gallup Strengths Finder. I don't know if you've ever done that, but it's an assessment just to kind of see where people are and what their natural gifts, their natural talents are. So I did that with my previous staff, done that with my current staff, and we all do things that are natural to us. We all have our own talents. So I look at a place with people's strengths, just not deficit. It's not what they're not good at. You know, if you're really administrative is not your thing, what are your talents? Where else can we elevate you? And you don't have to reorganize the whole business based on people's individual personalities. That would be exhausting. But you've got to look at the business and see how the individual personalities, how they can thrive within the business as it is and the organization as it is. So I think for me, it's just really empowering people with what they're already doing, what they're already great at. I think the biggest challenge of that is for the individual to trust themselves to make those decisions and to understand how great they really are. And I think that's really half the battle, is if you can get someone to understand what their talents and their strengths are, then you're doing pretty good.
That's awesome. Like, I can definitely, I feel that theme of empowerment too in my past and some of my current work too, also in disability advocacy and youth advocacy. It's really important to empower those voices. And like I said, you want to create leaders, not followers. The funny thing I was thinking is, you know who creates followers? Cult leaders. That's what they do. Not that everyone who creates followers is like that, but that could be the extreme of it, I guess.
Well, you want people to be able to lead if you can't be there. Mm-hmm. So if they're always relying on you for the answer, and I've never strived to be anybody's answer bank, and I want you to think on your own, and I do try to keep my opinion to myself sometimes. If there's something, if we need to change something, I want to hear whatever other people are thinking, because my opinion and my thought is just one. It doesn't mean that it's the right one just because of my title. And so I want to make sure everybody has a voice at the table and whenever we're making decisions. And if we're at events, I am new in my role. I have not planned one event. It is my team. And I think that my team is incredible. And so I show up, I want them to tell me what to do that day. Tell me exactly what it is you need from me, because you're the leader today. You're the leader of this event. You're the leader of this, of whatever it is that we're doing. And I need to know how I can support you. So I think that's when you create more leaders, you're really giving them just that and that power to be who they are, but to shine and to really thrive in the organization.
And with your leadership style, do you feel like you're someone who leads more with your head or with your heart?
Both. I've always had the mantra, the soft heart, strong mind. I think it was probably on Friday Night Lights or something. But that's one thing that I've always tried to lead with, is you've always got to lead from your heart. Nonprofit is, it's mission-driven business. So if you don't have that mission in front, then you're not going to make great decisions. But you've got to have a strong mind, because there are decisions that you still have to make that are business decisions that are going to impact the entire organization. And sometimes it can't be about somebody's feelings. It's just about reality. But keeping the humanness in the front of my mind is exactly the way I try to lead.
And with my own personal, I guess, leadership style, I have these three components, what I call my three M's: being an effective motivator, a competent manager, and a supportive mentor. So like motivator, manager, and mentor. How do you view those three roles? Do you see them as three separate things or three things that are tied together?
I think these are all three tied together, I think. And I think you just may have to lean heavier on one at any given time, just based on the person and the situation. I think there's times you'll need to lead from the front through motivation and courage. I think you lead from within or beside, as someone that knows what the work is within to help guide people. And at times you're going to lead from the back, which is supporting. And so, again, I think it all depends on the situation. And if you can become a great situational leader, then your organization and your people generally are going to thrive.
Okay. I appreciate you answering all those questions about leadership development. I'm going to ask a few questions about what I call my local global questions and a few fun questions, too. I want to start off with, what advice do you have for people who hope to become leaders, especially for someone who wants to run like a major organization or a nonprofit in particular?
Number one is be curious. You've got to find something that aligns with your personal values so that you'll be passionate about it. I love my job. I can say that every day I wake up, and it is hard work a lot of days, and it's long, long days, long weeks, but I love it. And so if you love what you're doing, I know that that doesn't always pay the bills, but if you can understand every level of whatever organization it is, The Boss? Undercover Boss.
Oh, yeah.
If you can understand what is going on inside the business, then you can lead a business, as long as you're seeing it from a perspective that is objective. And so I think that if you keep your mission at the front of your mind, your business decisions will stay where they're supposed to stay. But just learn everything that you can. Ask the questions. Step on the toes. Just learn the business.
That made me think having to know, like I said, in a business, having to know what's like happening in the business itself. Mm-hmm. Makes me think of one of my favorite shows, The West Wing. There's an episode where the president, the president's an economist, and then one of his staff members says, "Oh, Mr. President, you don't want to become one of those presidents who doesn't know what the price of a gallon of milk is." And then she's like, "Do you know that, sir?" And it's like, he doesn't know what the price of a gallon of milk is. And he's like, he's trying to run the country, but it's like, doesn't think of those day-to-day small things that you really need to understand.
You do. You have to see the little things to see the big picture. Mm-hmm. And if you don't see the big picture, you lose all of it. And I think that we can become tunnel vision, especially in nonprofit space, human service space. It is all about that person that's right in front of you or everything that is going on, when you've got to look at the whole thing and how that one individual experience is could impact the entire organization, could impact just so many other people and other things that are going on in the world. So you've got to look at the big picture always.
Yeah, definitely got to see the whole vision.
Yeah.
How do you, in your role, how do you kind of internalize or look at global identity or global citizenship, and how do global events, what's happening around the world, affect what you're doing as a leader in Kentucky?
I think this goes back to just connectedness, and we're all connected, and it doesn't really matter where you live. But if you limit yourselves to the bubble that you're born in, then you're never going to grasp that. So there's a statistic, it's 1 in 6 children are born with a disability. And that is not just in this country, that is not just in Kentucky, that is across the world. And I think that's where my work with Special Olympics has been so amazing, because it provides that opportunity for athletes on a global scale. We have local events, we have state events, regional, U.S. games, world games. So I think on a global scale, our athletes get to experience all of that with their peers, with their mentors, with their coaches. And I think that is, with global identity and global citizenship, is that that athlete from America is connected to the athlete from China. It doesn't matter. They're all still playing the same sport. and still playing the same game. And so I think that's where, with my work specifically, that I, how I would identify with global identity.
And it sounds like, yeah, the work you all do, it's really putting like Kentucky on the global map and showing them what, you know, what our Commonwealth has to offer, not just the country, but the whole world, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and they get to be celebrated for that. And next year will be our U.S. Games, and it's in Minnesota next year. And so that happens every 4 years, the World Games. Italy was earlier this year, and Chile will be in two years, I think. It comes every two years. So, again, it's not just here where we're sitting. It is everywhere.
But yeah, I was curious, like, you know, you kind of tease us in what you were saying before, like how global events affect you as a leader as Kentucky and like, you know, what's happening in athletics and sports around the world. Like, how does that tie into your work?
Okay. I think one of the most recent things that has impacted us on a local level at Special Olympics Kentucky are the tariffs and everything that is going on with that and the uncertainty. And an example is if you've ever gone to a Special Olympics event, or you will see that people have medals. We do medals, just the bronze, silver, gold, like everybody else. And we had made the decision to update our medals early in the year. We placed our order super early to make sure that we got them in time for June for our summer games. And when we placed the order, we had a certain cost. We had a certain time frame. By the time that it rolled around that they were going to be delivered, they sat in a port for quite some time because of the tariff situation. We were panicking that we weren't going to get the medals. And again, if you ever go to a Special Olympics event, that's a huge part of it, that you are there to compete. And because medals are not just given, you have to earn them. And it's just a big part of the day. It's a big part of the sporting event. And so we were panicked about that. And then we were told that we didn't know what our shipping cost was going to be. And we wouldn't know until the day that they rolled into port. Whatever it was on that day, it could be $50,000. And that was a quote that we got. And it could be $10,000. So we didn't know what our cost was going to be for those medals, just to be able to get them for our athletes. And at that point, we're ready to pay whatever we need to pay because our athletes come first. And there was no way that we were going to have summer games without medals. And so for a lot of people, that might be something small, but for us, that was a huge impact to our business. We were luckily able to, the tariffs were still what they were, and they were significantly higher than what we had budgeted for as far as that shipping cost. But we were able to get them nick of time, and it was literally the nick of time, and it worked out for us. Most nonprofits could not have done that. And so a big part of their program would have been impacted because of something that's going on in the world and not a decision that was made locally.
That's so interesting to hear. Like, yeah, I wouldn't think of, like, I mean, economic policies affecting your work too, like even those big picture things.
Yes.
And with that too, like, yeah, how in addition to like those, how do you kind of look at what's happening in athletics and sports around the world? Like, how does that tie into your work here in Kentucky?
We're always just keeping an eye on, I mean, one thing that we do is divisioning. We're looking at skill level. We really follow how sports, and especially in Kentucky, but we follow just guidelines in sports. We make sure that there's safety. We make sure that our athletes are meeting certain standards in order to participate, in order to qualify for certain things. So I think we're always just keeping an eye on that. So as safety standards change across the country and across the world, then we adjust as well. So that's one big way that we do it.
And one thing, I mean, I've been following a little bit in athletics, both in the work I do and just in watching sports. But I know mental health has become a major concern in athletics here in the U.S., but also globally, from athletes like dealing with stigma to the pressure of competition. I watch a lot of club soccer in Europe. So, like, you know, I hear players all over the world saying, like, it's really tough for them to deal with this pressure, the mental health struggles they have. Some of them have, like, started, you know, to do work in it or foundations themselves. You know, how have you followed that? And is that mental health stigma or those challenges, is that something that affects your work and affects the athletes you work with?
Oh, absolutely. And I think mental health, you have to consider that in every business and every level. But for us, it is, like I said, we keep the athletes, they are first in all of our decisions. And so one exciting thing that is happening is U.S. Games comes next year. We have certain qualifying factors that will get you to U.S. Games. We take a little over 60 athletes, And we have to consider the mental health of the athlete to make sure they can handle it. So they've got to meet a minimum time, qualifying time, for whatever their sport is. But we also have to consider, you may have somebody that's a fantastic athlete, but they can't be away from home. They've never flown and they don't want to fly because it's in Minnesota and we'll be flying. They don't work well with others. They don't work well under a coach that's not their typical coach. And so we have to consider all of those factors in choosing the athletes that we're going to take. So because it is a lot of pressure, it is a week-long event where the athlete is going to be away from home. They're going to be away from their normal surroundings. They're going to be away from their family. They're going to be relying on other people to make sure that they're getting to where they need to be. And they're also going to be competing in front of tens of thousands of people. So that is one consideration, probably the most recent that I can think of. We also have to look at our facilities. We have to look at to make sure that if someone has just any issues with too much overstimulation, are we preventing people by not letting them wear possibly something to cover their ears so that the noises aren't too loud? We've got to look at all of those things to ensure that the mental health is where it needs to be for our athletes so they can perform and that they can feel good about what they're doing.
So I appreciate you saying, too, that that's something to think about. You know, of course, in the sports realm, the athletic realm, but also for people like in different business, mm-hmm. different areas. It makes me think of some of the policy work I've done to consider the environment and what students with disabilities or students with conditions may need, like in school, like in the classroom.
Yeah.
And like accommodating their needs. I used to do a lot of work in juvenile justice and particularly considering, students with disabilities or youth with disabilities are treated in that system and like their needs to like the overstimulation even of like bright lights.
Yep.
Even at like yelling at someone, how that can affect a young person. But it's a lot, yes, of factors to consider.
It is. And I think that's one thing that I learned after COVID when I was still with Girl Scouts. We had a camp. So Girl Scout camp. And usually you're in a huge area to eat lunch, eat your meals. And in youth camps, I would assume it's this way across the board, not just Girl Scouts, but there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of noise, you know, a lot of echo. There's a lot of songs. There's a lot of things happening. But what we learned after that is we moved tables outside so that girls that was just too much because it's a lot. And if it was too much, they got to, you know, they can go sit outside. You don't have to stay in that space that makes you really anxious. And so I think that it's just one of those things you've always got to consider. And for people that maybe don't struggle with that on a daily basis or deal with that on a daily basis, they don't even think about it. I mean, that's our privilege, that when you don't have to think about it, that's privilege. And so I think that we have to be very mindful and very intentional about what we're doing and how we're doing it in the spaces, looking at, is it accessible? Is this going to be too much walking for an athlete? Do we need golf carts? What do we need to make sure that they can bring their best selves?
And with your current role as someone working in the athletic realm and disability inclusion to your past work in like women and girls empowerment, mm-hmm. how do you approach and view diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, you know, the DEIA, how do you approach that in your work?
So I think with my work we talked about earlier, it's always been about proper representation in both of those areas. So in Girl Scouts, the work provided opportunities for girls to see themselves in spaces where they typically may have not been present before. There's an annual event called GEMS. It's Girls in Engineering, Math, and Science. And girls get to have an all-day experience on a college campus and attend sessions led by, we would always try to get women to be leading that because when you see yourself in something, then you can become that. So mm-hmm. if you can see that in someone else. And so proper representation through Girl Scouts, that was one thing that I really loved that we did. I think with Special Olympics, it's giving athletes access to opportunity to compete, not only with other individuals with intellectual disabilities, but we also have unified partners. We have unified sports. And what that means is that there may be an individual without an intellectual disability and then an individual with an intellectual disability, they partner in certain sports. And so we have basketball, soccer, bocce, bowling. We also, and a lot of people don't know this about us, is that we help provide healthcare representation for individuals with intellectual disabilities. And we have access, Special Olympics Kentucky and Special Olympics Cross Country, provide athletes with access to medical care through, we host MedFests. And healthy athlete programming. So we also have a fantastic partnership with University of Louisville Medical School, where the athletes have actually gone to speak to medical students to talk to them about how they should talk with individuals with intellectual disabilities. So if they're going to be treating them, then they need to, there's certain things that they need to know just from a medical perspective. And another thing that we do is the athlete leadership program. This, again, it goes back to representation, and it's a leadership development program for a select group of athletes. They're chosen every year, and there's usually 10 to 15 every year. There's a focus on public speaking, professionalism for athletes to show up in a professional manner. And so they come to these classes, they learn about financial literacy. We just had a financial literacy class, and just other various leadership topics. And then the athletes graduate from that program, they become ambassadors to the program and for the program, and they will attend community events, they'll attend fundraisers, they will attend, they'll go and speak with legislators with me, they will go to Capitol Hill in D.C. And so there's, because they're the ones that should be telling the story, I shouldn't be telling the story. And so for athlete leaders, that gives them an opportunity to be represented in the community and the community that they serve. And one thing we did differently this year with the athlete leadership program is the athlete leaders, the ones that had already graduated, they taught the classes. And so they took what they have learned, and they're the ones talking to their peers, mentoring their peers through this. And it's phenomenal. I mean, it is one of the most fun that I have on a daily basis, just to be able to see these leaders in front of their peers and guiding them and helping them to understand what they need them to understand and how they can communicate to the general public. So that has been really tremendous for me, and just to provide that representation, especially in those different areas. It's not just sports. There's so much more. It's more about the whole athlete and not just one area.
Wow, that's really cool that you all provide like, I mean, those like wraparound supports. Like you, of course, like these are athletes here to play sports and do a competition, but you also think about that, like that financial literacy. I mean, of course, I think we all know healthcare is a big part of like providing for an athlete, but you put that up front, I think, more than maybe like most athletic organizations do. So that's really awesome that you do all of that.
Yeah. And it's because of part, we have great partners in the community, but it gives a lot of people with intellectual disabilities may not have access to the healthcare that they need. And especially in our state, that is one area that we're really trying to focus on, is in the underserved areas, because it may take 45 minutes to an hour to get somewhere. And gas is pretty expensive. Sometimes the transportation isn't there. And sometimes people just don't have specialists, don't have doctors that will meet their needs, their specific needs. And so we're able to provide glasses, sneakers, hearing aids. We're able to do dental care, all of these things that they get to come to one thing and experience that. And then they have a plan. They have a care plan, and that they can walk away with and know that this is something that they can maintain in their own community or come back to whenever we have these pop up.
That's awesome. That's so cool that you do like all that work. I wanted to ask now a couple more fun questions. I wanted to ask, what's your favorite sport to watch?
To watch is college football. I love college football, and I will have it on. I love the energy behind it, more so than NFL. And I also love watching soccer, especially if I know people playing, then I do love soccer.
Awesome. Yeah. Do you have a favorite college football team and a favorite soccer team?
Soccer team would be the local Henry Clay. Boys or girls, because that's where my kids played. And so as far as college football, I love U of L, UK. I mean, being in the state.
Yeah.
And I think it's just really, I love the SEC. And I know, because SEC to me is almost at the same level as pro.
Yeah.
And a little bit more exciting sometimes. So I think that I really like the energy that goes behind that. But I love to go to college football games in person. Just again, I think the energy.
Yeah, there really is a great energy. And I mean, like I said, we're a great state for that. And everyone be ready. Football season's coming up.
Yes, college, yes.
And yeah, so I'm, for soccer, for me, a huge fan of that. I mostly watch English Premier League, a Man City fan.
Yeah, my husband.
That's, oh, awesome. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
They set the records. What's your favorite sport to play?
To play, I would say, and especially this kind of aligns with what Special Olympics offers, is I love to ski. So that's one that we offer that also that I like to do. I would always help my kids with sports, but I can't say that I was as athletic as they were. Mm-hmm. But I think flag football is one of those two that my family and I have played together, and I like that.
I thought that's a great, yeah. That's a really great family sport. Yeah. I played some of that growing up too. What's your favorite event or competition that you've coordinated with Special Olympics of Kentucky?
So just to be clear, I've not coordinated or anything because I'm so new, but my staff, my team, they're the ones that have planned it, and because I'm 9 months in. So at this point, I get to kind of be just observing everything. Mm-hmm. But I would say my favorite one that I've attended since I started is Winter Games. Was incredible, and that was the first month that I was with Special Olympics Kentucky, and to see... And are you a skier?
I've done it once as a kid, so, but not a regular skier.
But to watch an athlete bring the torch down, mm-hmm. and it was in the evening, there were lights, and it was magical. I don't know how else to explain it, and I love skiing, I love winter, and so that was my first big event that I attended, and it was fantastic, and just to see volunteers that mm-hmm. came together to support the athletes. I would say the next one would probably be Summer Games, and that happens in June every year, and I think that was probably one of my favorites because there were so many different venues, so many things happening mm-hmm. All at once. There were couple thousand people there, and it's on EKU's campus, and just the energy that day, there was so much that led up to it to make it happen, and I saw everything that my team did in order to make sure that it happened the way it needed to, so that it looked seamless to our volunteers and to our athletes, so that everybody had a great experience. So I think, to me, just the teamwork behind that created Summer Games was pretty awesome.
That's amazing. That's awesome to hear those amazing events, those awe-inspiring mm-hmm. events that your team is putting on. I want to hear about more, where you've pulled leadership lessons from, what your sources are. So what are major leadership lessons that you've learned from books or publications you've read?
I think there were three that I listed. So No Ego by Cy Wakeman. And her book really focused on that your ego, it's what will hold you back. And I think there's a quote, ego is the downfall of man. Facts and accountability, you focus on that instead of the emotional narratives, that creates a more productive environment. So that's what I got out of that one. Winning by Jack Welch, I think that was written in the 90s maybe. And the biggest takeaway from that I had was the 20-60-20 theory. And this helped me, this kind of helps me in making decisions and especially change management, whenever you talk about DEI work, it is that 20-60-20, that 20% of the people, they're going to be on board. You don't have to convince that top 20%. Yeah. It's that 60%, that's kind of the sweet spot. They can go either way. And then that bottom 20, you're never going to be able to convince them. So that's not where you put your energy. So you put it in that 60 and then top 20, because that's where your energy is, you're going to get the highest ROI. But there's a bottom 20 that they're never going to get on board. And you have to identify that quickly so you know not to put your energy there and where it takes away from the people that are there to support and move forward. So I think I really liked that one. And then the most recent one that I read is Made from Scratch by Kent Taylor. He's the founder of Texas Roadhouse. And Texas Roadhouse, they're one of our largest sponsors. And so I have seen firsthand what their culture is like. And someone had recommended that I read this book. And it has got so many leadership lessons in it. And Kent Taylor, he passed away. But I think the major lesson that I learned from that is just drive and resilience. It just kind of goes from his struggle to get Texas Roadhouse and just the culture of Texas Roadhouse and what his priorities were. And it's don't take yourself too seriously and always put your people first. And I loved that book. And it's one of those that I'll continue to come back to because I think it's a real person that's writing, this book, and it just talking about everything that got him to where he wanted to be and what his vision was to provide just a great experience for customers and for his staff. And like I said, I've seen this firsthand, and just the people that work at Texas Roadhouse in corporate and in the restaurants. It's just been pretty, it's a great book. So, and it's a great audiobook too, if you're an audiobook person. So, I think those are my top three as far as actual books at this point.
Definitely got to check those out and read them myself or listen to them. What are leadership lessons you've pulled from pop culture, whether movies, TV, musical artists, or even celebrities?
Ted Lasso.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think Ted Lasso is it's so great. Mm-hmm. But I love the goldfish mentality of that if you make a mistake, adjust and move forward. But you cannot, you can't continue to admire the problem, because if you do that, it's just going to, you're going to stay in that space and you can't do that. I also loved, and I don't remember exactly what he said, but it's just the, it's one of his tirades, the practice. Practice matters. And I think in business, in the business world, that means preparation. So if you have properly prepared or properly practiced, then whenever you need it, you're going to be able to pull from there. So I love Ted Lasso for that, and the muscle memory that he focuses on. Like, if you keep doing these things, then whenever the time comes that you've got to, you have to handle something, it's just, it's there. The other one I love, and this is Coach Carter. I don't know. It's a movie long time ago. And I think that one has always kind of been important for me. And there's a Marianne Williamson is there's a quote or a poem, and just some snippets of it is, our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. It's our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. Your playing small does not serve the world. And as we let our own light shine, we consciously give other people permission to do the same. And for me, that movie has always just hit a chord with me, that I loved just the philosophy behind it.
I definitely have to watch that. But happy to hear Ted Lasso, yeah, one of my favorite shows. that got me through the pandemic. So
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Great coach. Great inspiration. Mm-hmm. Who would you say are your most important leadership role models?
I think that people will know. I would say Dolly Parton is one. And I think that she, because of her, everybody knows who she is. She is just unapologetically her authentic self. And whether you agree with that or not, I think that it's, she just shows up as she is. And she wants people to do the same. And there's no, she doesn't lean any certain way. She's just the kindness, I think, of her. And there was a podcast, I think it's Dolly Parton's America. And it goes into, it's one of my favorite podcasts, because it goes into her songs and the, you know, the reason, the stories behind her songs. I loved that one. The other one would be Eunice Kennedy Shriver, and she's the founder of Special Olympics. Oh, yeah. And I didn't know a lot about Mrs. Shriver until I started with Special Olympics, and I'm pretty amazed. I think that she was way before her time, and I think that she is a prime example of someone. Her sister had an intellectual disability, and because of the love that she had for her sister, she was able to see. And I think that that is one thing that a lot of us with empathy, that you have to see what is sometimes unseen. And I think that that is something that she always managed to do, and she did something about it. She didn't just stand back. You know, her sister would have been well taken care of based on her family, mm-hmm. but she wanted more for her sister and more for people with intellectual disabilities. And so she created Special Olympics, and she didn't take no for an answer. And I love that, because I think that in a time that she lived in, it would have been very, I'm sure she was told no a lot, but she kept moving forward and she kept doing what she needed to do. And now I think that there's over 3 million athletes across the world, Special Olympic athletes, the last statistic that I saw. Wow. And there's a great, it's ESPN, the 30 for 30. I don't know if you've ever watched any of those. Hers, about her, it's called Brave in the Attempt. And I think for me, that was incredible, just to see what this one woman could do and how she could literally change the world with just being tenacious and just being driven to do what needed to be done.
Those are definitely great inspirations. Are there any other like local or global leaders you look up to? I mean, those are amazing leaders you named already.
I love our governor. I love Andy Beshear. And I love, just because I think that we're a unique state. And I appreciate when people, again, can meet people where they are. And I appreciate when people can bridge gaps. And that's one thing that I think he's done a great job of. And it's not been easy, but I also think he has the respect on both sides, and mm-hmm. that's not easy either. So I do have a respect for him.
Yeah, great figure. And we started this interview with your six-word story. Now I want to end it and hear, what would you say is your six-word legacy? That's 6 words you want people to envision when they think about your legacy for Kentucky and the world.
Okay. So I made this a little wordy, but I would want people to remember me for the love that I gave, the belonging that they felt, empowerment that they experienced, resilience that they learned by failing and trying again, courage that they showed, and kindness that they gave to others. I think that would be my legacy. And I ultimately would want people to know that they matter and how we treat each other in this world. We're creating that for ourselves. And so it's not that hard to just be kind. You just be kind to somebody. And it just makes it all better for yourself. It makes it better for everyone else. And it's really not that hard. So I think that would be what my legacy would be.
And that's such a great legacy to leave. Angie, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. Such a great honor to meet you and to hear about the amazing work you're doing and you have done and that you'll continue to do for our Commonwealth. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That concludes my conversation with Angie Krustinch, a thoughtful and candid exchange. I admire her openness in acknowledging past mistakes and the growth that followed, and her commitment to meeting people where they are, to cultivating independent-minded leaders, and to making sure every voice is heard really reflects a powerful vision for inclusive leadership. And if you want to attend or experience some of the awesome events and competitions that Special Olympics Kentucky hosts, please visit their website at soky.org. Again, that's soky.org, and check out their events page. My next episode will be released in December, and it will feature John Kohlinger, the Executive Director of Kentucky Refugee Ministries. Remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.